Broadcasting on the Drug Truth Network, this is Cultural Baggage.
It's not only inhumane, it is really fundamentally un-American.
My name is Dean Becker. I don't condone or encourage the use of any drugs, legal or illegal. I report the unvarnished truth about the pharmaceutical, banking, prison, and judicial nightmare that feeds on eternal drug war. Eternal war against flowers. Eternal war against a noun. Errors piled high with political excrement yield more flowers and fresh pipe dreams of war to destroy all that is evil. Human rendition, unending detention, veiled truths and uncovered lies through media's hypnosis create fear and psychosis that prevent rational values to ascend from the mire. Freedom is in the balance.
The drug supply market is highly sophisticated, and attempts to intervene have not resulted in sustainable disruption to the market at any level. As a result, the supply of drugs has increased. Prices are low enough not to deter initiation, but prices are high enough to cause heavy users to commit high levels of crime to fund their habits. That concise summation of the complete failure of the drug war was not written by a reformer or some libertarian think tank. It's the conclusion of a secret report prepared for the Prime Minister of Great Britain by his own strategy unit. The document, presented to Mr. Blair in 2003, was finally leaked to the press last weekend. According to the Guardian newspaper, the report says that, quote, traffickers enjoy such high profits that seizure rates of 60 to 80% are needed to have any serious impact on the flow of drugs into Britain, but nothing greater than 20% has been achieved, end quote. Copies of the report in electronic form are available from the Common Sense for Drug Policy website, as well as from UK-based news websites. Put it at the top of your summer reading list. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org.
Welcome to this edition of Cultural Baggage. I'm proud to have as our guest tonight Mr. Jeff Blackburn. He, you may have heard of him for his work in the Tulia trials, where he helped to free the people condemned by the word of an itinerant undercover cop. He's currently working for the West Texas Innocence Project, and I'm proud to welcome him to the show.
Well, thanks for having me, Dean. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Jeff. I noticed today, driving in on one of my 420 reports, I called you the Texas Lawman of the Year. Of course, that's not true, that you are the Texas Defense Attorney of the Year. But you work for a bigger set of laws, in my opinion, one involving common sense and logic. Jeff, tell us about the West Texas Innocence Project.
What we're trying to do up here in this forgotten region of the state, the Big Empty, from Amarillo to Lubbock down to Midland, Odessa, and then ultimately way out into the deep desert around El Paso, is bring some measure of counterbalance, some measure of institutional weight all on our own to a system that, especially in many rural counties, has gone completely out of control. It's no mistake that I think that there are many, many examples of injustice all over the state, but there are no more grave examples of injustice than you can find in places like Tulia, for example. And there are lots of Tulias out there, 2, 3, 4, 5, many more of them. And we're convinced that in this region in particular, there are more of those going on a daily per capita basis than any other part of the state.
Jeff, we have what I call daily Tulias right here in the city of Houston. We arrest about 79 people every day of the week for drugs, and yet our district attorney proclaims ignorance. He doesn't quite understand what's going on. He's just doing his job. Well, what's your thought in that regard, the major cities and how they run this drug war?
Well, you know, the basic objectives of the drug war, which is, I think, are primarily, it's a little complicated to try to understand the whole picture, but at the same time, it's not that complicated. There is a need in this society that grows more pressing each day to marginalize, dispossess, and generally get rid of people you don't want around. There is no better way to do that than drug prosecutions and arrests. That sociological, political, and economic need is present whether you're in Houston or Tulia or in the middle of Culberson County out in the desert. The thing is, they've generally, the people that, that perpetrate that policy and execute that policy find it easier to get by, especially in rural areas, with the same old tired rhetoric and with the same kind of political support that they've always enjoyed. Houston, on the other hand, at least has folks like you and a lot of others that are willing to stand up and do something about it. There's a great Innocence Project at U of H that was founded by David Dow, the guy that's done so much to expose what's wrong with the Harris County Crime Lab. And there's still enough people where that will listen to that kind of information and act on it. So the policy reasons are the same. The policy that's being executed is the same. The form it takes is what's different. And the reason that we have to be concerned with that, the difference in form, is that what we have to do right now, we being activists, lawyer types, and folks in the community that want to really seriously redress problems in this justice system in Texas and nationally, the biggest problem is that we have to find symbolic cases that will wake people up and show them no one cares about a daily roundup in scattered instances of black people or brown people in Houston, Texas. That's just not the kind of issue that you can galvanize people with. When you eliminate an entire population in a town, an ethnic population, then you might be able to get somebody's attention. There are more problems than there are solvers of those problems to go around right now. And there are a lot more problems than people are willing to pay attention to. So we've got to go out and search and find outrageous examples of injustice, promote those with the idea of changing people's hearts and minds a little bit.
Last week, you and I were talking candidly, I suppose, about all the TV shows, Crime Lab this, Crime Lab that, and how these technicians are presented as if they are, grandchildren of Sherlock Holmes, tracing the footprints of rats and so forth. But there's too much credence. There's too much handed off to these people in these crime labs, especially as Houston has shown.
I think that's very true. But, the prevalence of this new popular mystique about forensic evidence and crime lab type analysis has, like most things that they get set in motion by those that rule in this country, created a lot of really unforeseen consequences and weird dynamics for them. I mean, on the one hand, yeah, people put way too much credence in something that can dress itself up as science that usually is junk. On the other hand, what I think many of us who are trying cases in criminal courts throughout this state are beginning to see is that we can use this sort of popular conception that there ought to be solid forensic evidence and a lot of material to back up a conviction to our advantage. I did that in a sex offense case that I tried. They had swabbed for DNA. They did the DNA analysis, and it wasn't the guy. Somebody else's DNA. It wasn't the guy that was accused. The state, of course, pressed on anyway. The jury, in a very, very right-wing backward county, gave them a real strong slap in the face by winding up hung 10-2 for acquittal. That's the positive result of this popular concept that there's some magic science that solves all crimes. The negative result, I think, is more overwhelming, though, and that is an increase in blind faith of authority. And I don't know if that's really because of the technique being used or the spread of forensic technique, or whether that's more just the result of maybe a deeper political need that people feel right now to trust authority.
Well, Jeff, as I told you, I was going to try something new. We're going to interweave some of our reports from the Drug Truth Network during our discussion, maybe give us some talking points. This is from our good friend here at the station, Mr. Phil Jackson.
Now for another black perspective on the drug war. War is any means of breaking the will of the enemy. But in the drug war, there is no enemy. Only sons and daughters, parents, neighbors, and co-workers. These are people we love. Some of my family have asked me how I can possibly look at all the terrible effects of drugs on black neighborhoods and black youth and still oppose the war on drugs. It may not be perfect, but someone has to do something. But what if that something causes more harm than good? What if there is a safer, saner, more compassionate, and more effective something we could be doing? Right now, the focus of America's anti-drug effort is punitive. We heap staggering punishments on some drug users to deter them and others from further drug use. But if drug abuse were treated as a public health issue instead of a criminal issue, then we could be treating people for medical problems instead of incarcerating people with criminal problems. We could preserve and enhance the productivity of our citizens and help our neighborhoods grow stronger. Maybe it's time to stop making war on our own people and start making peace. Start making progress. Start making sense of America's senseless drug policy. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Phil Jackson.
We are speaking with Jeff Blackburn, an attorney here in Texas, head of the West Texas Innocence Project. Jeff, you heard Mr. Jackson there. Is it making any sense? Does this drug war have any logic to it, sir?
Well, it has a logic to it, but it doesn't have a sound logic to it. The logic and the dynamic behind it, I think, is exactly what Phil explained and what a lot of the rest of us, mainly, and I've got to give you, again, maximum credit for doing what you do by just putting the word out there and taking a stand and repeating that stand to anybody that'll listen. And I think the numbers are growing, in fact, of people who will listen. But you know, the truth is, the logic behind the drug war is a twisted logic. It's an evil kind of logic. It's the logic of a government machine that has found a way to profit from the confusion and pain that leads people to use drugs to begin with, or at least drugs that they can't get because they're not connected enough through a doctor who will write them a prescription. I mean, ultimately, all drug cases come down to is just the possession and distribution of non-prescription painkillers anyway. But what we've seen is the growth of a government bureaucracy, an enforcement machine that doesn't want to go away, that has its own reasons to exist now, and that isn't going to give up. So the logic behind it, illogical as it may be, is the logic of any government institution that's been allowed to go too far and is constantly going to keep trying to feed itself and grow and expand.
And if you'll allow me, Jeff, I have a little editorial I'd like to follow that with.
Great.
Those who put forth that users of certain flowers and potions are inhuman, unworthy of respect and dignity as fellow humans, have much in common with the infamous dwellers of Sodom. Those currently in positions of power have decided that flower smokers and powder sniffers are immoral, untrustworthy and dangerous, and therefore expendable. In effect, a crop they can harvest for themselves. Those in power proclaiming it to be their moral obligation, therefore set out to interrogate, disrobe, search, beat, arrest, and send to prison for long-term lessons in sodomite behavior, those who use plant products the sodomites disapprove of. Proclaiming themselves Christians and subject to God's desire on earth, they shred the Constitution, test a lie in court, and otherwise put forth proclamations and laws, and ultimately prison sentences and conditions that would be better reserved for those sent to hell. Ignorance of the mechanisms of law can no longer be an excuse for this abomination of drug war. Sodomites love the drug war. It's how I perceive it, and I don't know if you've heard, sir, we offer the DOT Award. It's named after my recently deceased mother. It's not much in the financial scheme of the drug war, $1,000 to any drug war who will come on our show and explain to us the need for more drug war.
I don't guess you've had many takers for that yet.
No, sir, we have not. As I understand, you guys are currently working on about 5 projects for the West Texas Innocence Project, and one of them being a former attorney, Mr. Roach. Tell my listeners more about that situation.
Oh, I'd love to. In West Texas, the drug war makes for good, solid election campaigns. One of the issues that we've seen emerge in judicial and district attorney races, and this is true throughout the state too, but it's especially virulent up here, is this sort of scenario. You get a reasonable DA who does his job, which is essentially to tell the police no lots of times. You know, no, you didn't follow the law. No, you didn't have probable cause to search somebody's car. No, your case is BS, and I'm not going to take it. I'm not going to file it. Well, the cops get mad at that sort of thing. Now, West Texas especially has a long tradition of what I would call sort of regular honorable street lawyer types being DAs. You know, we don't have the kind of careerism in DA's offices that larger cities like Houston suffer from. Frequently, the DA is a guy who's been a defense lawyer or maybe wants to be a judge and is really not that much different than the legal community that he came from, which is typically a fairly small group of people. In Amarillo, for example, the number of lawyers that do criminal cases are probably 30, 40 people. Typically, many judges and DAs will come from that group. In the old days, it was understood that a DA would be just a lawyer first and foremost, somebody that put the law above favoritism and that put the law above playing favors with cops. Those days are definitely headed out, and one of the people that made those days go away in West Texas was a guy named Rick Roach. He ran against and defeated in a very, very, very narrow election a man named John Mann for election to district attorney of the 31st Judicial District. Now, this covers a part of the state that many of your listeners may not have ever even thought existed. It's five counties, two of which are strung along I-40, which is a great national artery in which many, many people drive up and down. These five counties in the northern part of the state, Gray, Wheeler, Roberts, Lipscomb, some places that, you know, no one has ever heard of. Lipscomb County has an overall population, I think, of less than 1,000. And a couple of minor cities in this general area, like Pampa, Texas, and a town called Wheeler, and another town called Canadian. Those are all in the district. John Mann, again, a reasonable lawyer that most people liked and nearly everybody admired for trial skill, said no. Said no one too many times, maybe 10 too many times, to the cops who were ever busy, especially DPS officers, trying to make their own names by arresting people up and down I-40. Consequently, he became a political target of law enforcement. They found and recruited a guy by the name of Rick Roach to run against him about, this was 8 years ago. And Roach, who was of, let's just say, very questionable legal provenance. This was a guy who had come from that area originally, but had bounced around two or three different law firms after he got out of law school, had apparently had drug problems in the past, and had gone through a private rehab clinic. Roach was the kind of guy, sort of like Tom Coleman, the cop in Tulia, who was on such thin ice that he was willing to grab at any opportunity to get legitimacy and to get a career underway. So at the age of four, I think he was in his early 40s when he ran. He ran against this very respected, popular lawyer named John Mann, certainly very popular with other lawyers and always considered by us to be one of us. Roach's campaign was ugly, nasty, all based on support that he received from the DPS officers, from the local cops. He turned the race into a matter of who was for the drug war and who was going to lock up drug users, and just preyed on the typical fears that you would expect to exist in rural Texas and rural America. Got elected by a very narrow margin. And proceeded to do what he promised to, namely hand down and get juries motivated to give ridiculous sentences, 99 years, life, aggravated, you know, or aggregated or stacked life sentences on even minor drug crimes. The sort of corruption you would really expect to see began to follow. One of his more interesting practices involved stopping people up and down I-40 in two of the counties that he had, which I-40 intersects, searching their cars in the event that no drugs were found, but some money, typically over anywhere between $2,000 to $5,000 and beyond. In that event, they would charge these folks with money laundering, a crime that doesn't even begin to fit the conduct involved, indict them, seize the money, and then at some later date, tell them, well, I'll tell you what, we'll drop the criminal charge of money laundering against you, but we'll take two-thirds of your money and give a third back to you. And your lawyer, of course, who, as we've now begun to discover, was the same lawyer in virtually every single case. We haven't quite figured out how that came to be yet, but we have some suspicions. In any event, this was absolute, total, complete highway robbery. This was just the practice that was being engaged in for years, and it made millions of dollars for the counties. These are very rural, impoverished, collapsing economy kind of counties. And so everybody loved the practice. Everybody said, rah, rah, let's move on. Do it some more. You're putting away vicious drug dealers. We're getting rich. Or if not rich, we're at least getting better patrol cars. And everything continued and went fine until about a year ago when it was revealed by someone in his office, apparently, that Roach had his own problems, namely that he was filching methamphetamine from the evidence room and using it to feed a habit that had gone, by any account, completely out of control. This guy was a mainline injector of methamphetamine on a daily basis, continuing to put himself out as a fundamentalist and a Christian and a drug warrior, while at the same time being high, sort of a la Rush Limbaugh every day. Just an absurd, outrageous hypocrite, an evildoer with government authority of the worst kind, and somebody who, apparently now we've begun to realize, everybody realized had a problem and no one did anything about, because he was simply making too much money for all the players up there.
Jeff, that rings of the Sheriff of Nottingham or something. That's just awful. Well, Jeff, we're going to take our midpoint break here. We'll be back in 1 minute.
Sure.
Try to picture the drug war as a freight train, more than 9 miles long. Cars 10 feet wide, 63 feet long, and 15 feet high, filled with $100 bills. 4,400,000 cubic feet of $100 bills. More than 1,100 tons of sweet Benjamins. More than $11 trillion frittered away on this drug war. But hell, I guess everybody loves trains.
It's time to play Name That Drug by Its Side Effects.
Blurred vision, cold sweats, fast heartbeat, nausea, nervousness, shakiness, faintness, slurred speech, confusion, diseases of the adrenal, pituitary, and thyroid gland, or kidney and liver disease, and death. Time's up the answer, insulin, another FDA-approved product. Drug czar of the Americas, John Walters.
High-potency marijuana ought not to be considered as a marijuana was in the past. It ought to be considered another new drug.
To learn the truth about this matter, I urge you to visit the website of the Marijuana Policy Project at mpp.org.
Okay, you're listening to Cultural Baggage. Our guest is Jeff Blackburn, the Texas Defense Attorney of the Year. I don't know if you had a chance to catch the first report out of UK, the 105-page report telling Tony Blair that the drug war was never going to work. That got zero attention in the United States press, not one mention in the media. And your thoughts on that, sir? How do we break that cycle?
Well, you know, there are wonderful allies, except when they do something smart and rational like this. Then we try to take our distance from them. I mean, you know, the Brits are... I have made a business out of being a lot smarter than we are for a long time. You know, they actually worry about real reasons behind policies and examine policy and say, well, maybe we ought to abandon it if it doesn't work. You know, heaven forbid we do something like that in the United States.
Well, just 2 years ago, the Canadian Senate issued a report pretty much saying the very same thing. It's like the United States can't buy any science unless it's crafted by people they buy and trust, I suppose.
That's right.
You have seen over your career the changes. Is it getting worse? Is the drug war really just ratcheting up continuously?
Yes, it is. But I got to tell you, just to paraphrase Dick Cheney, I think that that this thing is ultimately in its last throes. And of course, you know, there was a lot of after he described the resistance in Iraq as being in its last throes. There was this tortured effort by the administration to say, well, a throw can last a long time. And I got to tell you, even though, you know, I hate to be remembered as a guy that agreed with the Bush administration on anything, they're right. A throw can last a while. And I think this throw is going to last a little while longer, maybe even, and certainly a lot longer than most of us that I think advocate a more progressive policy would want. But the truth is, this thing is beginning to come to an end. There's simply too much rational evidence and too many rational people who don't think it's a good idea anymore. And frankly, I think the money is beginning to run out. You know, as usual, once the money runs out, the stuff hits the fan. And policies have to start getting ejected and jettisoned that don't work anymore. And I think for a lot of reasons that don't have anything to do with the wrong-headed nature of political decision-making in this country, but have everything to do with the natural ebb and flow of this kind of economy that we're in, I think we're going to run out of money. And I think that once we do, all of the reasonable voices that have been raised, and also I think all of the examples that have been made out of people like Roach that I described earlier, just these complete criminals who've used this drug war to further their own objectives and make money and steal and filch, I think that all those stories are going to suddenly gain a lot more traction with people. People are going to pay a lot more attention, and this thing is going to go. And at least come out at the end in a severely modified way that most of the rest of us can live with a whole lot better. It's just going to take some more time, and it's going to take more persistent effort on the part of folks like you and people who are fighting these kinds of cases and working to expose these kinds of injustices to get our voices heard. But those voices will be heard, and I think that we're really towards the end of this thing.
Well, Jeff, as I mentioned earlier, I try to, give the Dot Award to anyone who comes on our show. And as it turns out, I have to bribe our reporter, Mr. Winston Francis, to do the official government truth.
Today I want to talk to you about the growing prison population and how it pertains to the drug war. Now, it's no secret. A lot of people go to jail on drug charges when they're otherwise good people. But try to remember that the drug laws are no secret either. Everyone knows what drugs they can and can't possess. So how could anyone contend that these citizens do not deserve their sentences? Here in America, you have the right to fight to change the law, but you do not have the right to break the law. Think about this. Where would our society be without order? Does anyone actually think that freedom would prosper in lawless chaos? Of course it wouldn't. That's why the law has to be enforced, and citizens must respect the law. This is the only way to preserve our freedom. It's the government's responsibility to see that citizens with no regard for the law find themselves in jail so that they may suffer and learn. Spare the cell, spoil the citizen. Get it? This has been Winston Francis with the official government truth.
Jeff, we only got about 30 seconds. Some closing comments, sir.
We are at the end of this thing. It doesn't seem that way right now. But we are coming very close to the end of all the injustice and drug policy. There'll be plenty of more injustice to work against. So don't anybody think we're going to get to be lazy. But we're definitely coming to the end of this. Thanks to you and a lot of other people for standing up and fighting.
I thank you for joining us, Jeff, and you know I'll be calling on you again soon. Thank you
so
much. All right. Next week, our guest will be Allison Merton, a Canadian who's the first person to take Sativex. And as always, because of drug prohibition, I remind you, you don't know what's in that bag. Please be careful.
To the Drug Truth Network listeners around the world, on behalf of engineer Philip Guthy, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage and the Unvarnished Truth. The show produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston.
Tap dancing on the edge of an abyss.